G'day, I'm Sean and welcome to the Car Expert Podcast. We are back. We had a week off last week between Easter and I had a little jaunt over to Western Australia, which we'll talk to you about in the coming weeks. But Scott and James had some homework, which you guys have brought this week. We're going to talk about EV running costs, which has been requested quite a lot. So we're going to finally get to that. We're going to talk about VFACTS because VFACTS in March numbers are up, which is small surprise considering your early predictions for 2024 is still looking bad.
We've been saying for a while now we're expecting the good times to stop and they just keep rolling. So I don't know if we're wrong or people are trying to prove us wrong or how that's working, but
Australian car buying public have set out just to prove you two wrong. Just, I think that's
I don't
what
even
it's
know
about.
That was my prediction, to be honest. So.
I'm bringing you down with you.
And we're also going to talk about the Kia Sportage Hybrid, but let's dive right into VFACTS because there's a lot of numbers to break down here. And the big news is, well, Toyota is still top of the charts, but the Hilux is no longer in the top three in terms of models, which is like, shock horror, right?
I think we talk about this often. It comes down to where it is in its life. There is a new Hilux model rolling out, the V-Active Technology 48-volt mild hybrid. It's not a catchy name.
I don't think it's going to stick.
But when we get into these numbers, we'll say like Mitsubishi, for example, is really surging back up the charts and the new Triton's just launched. So often you can attribute these things to supply and model changeovers. Wouldn't surprise me if Toyota is finally rolling out the last of the old Hilux, getting ready to bring this new bad boy in, and there's some people waiting for the 48 volt.
Yeah. All right, James, do you want to run us through the top five? Just give the people at home.
Yeah, no worries. So the top selling vehicle of the month was the Ford Ranger with 5,661 units. Second was the RAV4.
Dude, that's a surprise. That's a jump up for the RAV4.
Yeah, RAV4 had a really great month. And I think Toyota's been saying that they've got improved supply, particularly of hybrids. And I think that's really what's driven this number here. Third was the Tesla Model Y, which was back into the top three with 4,379. Hilux, as we mentioned, was on 3,995, which is quite a bit down on its usual rate. And then fifth was the Mitsubishi Outlander, which I think may have had an all-time record with 2,764 units.
Really good for the Outlander. And again, these are ones like, RAV4, Model Y, there's been such big supply issues and getting them into the country. And I came back from the airport this morning. I had an Uber driver who had a brand new Camry and he said he only had to wait 6 weeks for it.
Which wow. That's a huge turnaround.
Yeah. So, I mean, you talk about improved supply. I think that says a lot about that. Mm. Looking at some of the percentage changes, like Mitsubishi, like you said, it's got 34% increased sales month on month.
Compared to the equivalent month in 2023.
Yes. 2023.
So, call it March.
March 2023.
Sorry.
Yeah, it was a while ago. Wow. And Toyota, 43% increase. So, I mean, that's quite large jumps. Mazda, 0% increase. Is that, I hope that's not a math error, but
it's pretty incredible if they have sold exactly the same number of cars both times. I think what we're seeing here, and if you look at all these brands, so Toyota is talking about really improved hybrid supply. It had a massive increase in hybrid deliveries for the month. This is something that's been coming for quite a while. Ford had a massive month of Rangers, obviously. Mitsubishi's got the new Triton fully on stream, up and running and launched now, and it had a big Outlander month as well. And even Kia, it has the Sportage Hybrid now on deck. We're expecting to see stronger sales from that too. So in a lot of cases here, these are cars that people might have ordered a little while ago and are now arriving, or they've just been holding out for, because ultimately when there are, you know, vehicles that are coming with significant upgrades, people are willing to wait. And if you've already been waiting for 10 or 12 months, why would you not wait two more and get the hybrid instead of the petrol, for example?
So one of the big things that I noticed, and we'll get to what you guys, what caught your eye, but 10,500 thereabout deliveries were EVs, which makes it nearly a 10% market share for the month. So, I mean, obviously Tesla is up, but where else are we seeing the EV increase?
I think across a lot of the Chinese brands, they're still fairly steady. And I think going by the fact that so many of these cars weren't actually available for sale this time last year, you've just got a whole range of new models that are just adding incremental volume on top of what was already coming out of Tesla. So I think that's really where the main drive has been from.
For me, I'm really interested by the luxury side of things. And I noticed in the sedan segment over $60,000, Tesla Model 3 is the best seller and has been for a little while. But BMW 3 Series and then the i4 came in second and third. We have recently done a video about the i4 and the 3 Series side by side. I've also recently driven that base i4. It's a really excellent car, and if you can make the numbers work for you, it stacks up as a really compelling alternative to the 3 Series. I find it amazing that BMW has managed to knock off the C-Class and the Audi A4 with a pure electric in that segment. It now kind of owns that space, or at least it did last month.
Well, I think to BMW's credit, they actually have options available with their cars.
And at a reasonable price.
And at a reasonable price. Yeah, James, what caught your eye this month?
I know that electric has been, you know, a talking point for quite a while, but the fact that hybrid and plug-in hybrid sales were both well up over the 100% mark.
Who's buying plug-in hybrids?
Well, apparently 1,400 people.
In future weeks, I will tell you a story about a plug-in hybrid that might just change your mind, but we will get to that.
But it seems that, you know, as more things become available, supply improves, we're starting to see a lot of this stuff improve as well, and to see that, you know, altogether hybrid, electric and plug-in hybrid sales take up a really big, I think it was almost a third of the market now. That shows that Australians are willing to take on new and electrified powertrain technologies as long as they're available and at an attainable price.
One of the things I note is the numbers for, like, I guess sub $30,000 cars are not as high as we would expect. Considering everyone's saying cars are too expensive, not a lot of people are buying cars under 30 grand. And I know that the options are limited, but I mean, do you think that the people that, like, there's just a small number of people that are saying cars are too expensive, but you know, people are actually just speaking with their wallets and buying?
I think cars are definitely, we know cars are more expensive, and I think people have definitely noted it. But there is also a point where there is no option. You look at a Toyota Yaris or a Toyota Corolla now, they barely come in below 30 grand. It's not as if people don't necessarily want those cars, but when there are only, call it, three or four viable options under 30 grand in that small car segment, even if you want to, there's not necessarily enough options there to drive those bigger sales numbers. I think the other thing is, in Australia at the moment, the vehicles that are really driving growth are obviously dual cab utes, mid-size SUVs, and then there are some electric options as well. And none of those fit in that segment. So there are a lot of people who are still looking for a cheap car, but a lot of them who were looking for a cheap car, call it 5-10 years ago, have now graduated to something bigger and better.
Fair enough. So boy, they were spending 30 grand that many years ago, they're now looking at $60,000 or $70,000. Yeah, fair enough. All right, I'm gonna give you guys a chance to redeem yourselves on your early 2024 predictions. What do you think we're gonna look like in April?
Oh, okay. I'm so far in on this prediction now, I'm standing by it. I don't know whether it'll come to pass in April or not, but everything we have heard from economic forecasting bodies, from car makers, from the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, is that eventually this historical demand that we're seeing play out now, Toyota being a great example of that, will stop, and that the current order bank will be reflected in these numbers, and that will show lower sales. So whether it's April or not, I'm not sure. And I do think that the way Toyota's been speaking for a little while now, it's going to have another couple of strong months as RAV4s start arriving. But eventually in the next couple of months, we will see things cool off a little bit. This record run just can't keep going. And based on everything we were hearing at the end of last year, it won't keep going. And again, if I'm sitting here in a month's time and I'm wrong again, I'm wrong again.
I mean, if you're sitting here in December when you're still wrong, then we're really going to take it.
I hope by then I will have changed my prediction slightly.
All right, James, where do you think we're going to be in April?
I think April probably won't be too different to March. I think we'll still see things stay fairly level. I think if there's going to be a drop off like we've been talking about for a while, it may not be to at least the second half or the fourth quarter, because there's still so many things coming in. And I think now that wait times and supply are improving, it might be people that have previously dropped off of waiting lists coming back on now because they can actually get a car now. So I don't know. I still think that we've still got a few more months of this solid volume to come.
And just to counter your prediction a little bit, Scott, over the last couple of months, we've seen numerous car makers slash their prices, especially in like the EV and hybrid space. Do you think that, like, do you guys think that might increase a bit of sales, or do you think that their OEMs are anticipating a drop in sales and they're trying to get ahead of it?
You don't cut prices unless you need to. And car makers have for quite a long time now been either racking their prices up or not really negotiating. This is on a dealer side as well, because they have more demand than there is supply. The fact that there are price cuts coming, especially on some of the electric stuff, shows that the market is sort of normalizing a little bit. Whether or not these people have jumped early or they're already seeing it, I'm not sure. But as trends go, that transition of power back from the car maker and the dealer to the buyer is something that we expect to continue. And it's a really good reason to use Help Me Car Expert or our deals page to find yourself a good deal on a new car.
There you go. Simply Google Help Me Car Expert and get yourself a better deal. Thank you for doing the plug for me this week, Scott. All right, let's move on to EV running costs. This has been a long requested thing. It is really hard to do. I mean, we've spent a few hours this morning trying to actually figure out the nuts and bolts of this. And I guess we want to be as specific for you guys as possible, but we can't be too specific because each person that buys an EV is going to have a completely different use case for it. So what we've done is we've taken a RAV4 hybrid base model. we've taken that as our sort of control car. As it's economical, it's fairly well priced.
Incredibly popular.
Yeah. Very common on the roads. And then we've taken the cheapest EV that you can currently buy, the middle of the road and I guess most popular EV you can buy, the Model Y, and a market Model EV with the Kia EV9. So we didn't want to go crazy. We don't want BMW i7s or anything. We're just cars that people are actually going to buy. So let's try and get some of these numbers out just to help make sense. And if you are watching on YouTube, I will put some graphics on the screen. If you're listening, feel free to jump back and take notes and get a handle on it, because there's a lot of numbers that are about to come at you. So just to start out with, RAV4 Hybrid is $42,260 to buy before on-road costs. It uses an average of 4.7 litres per 100 kilometres. We've based all of these calculations on an average of 10,000 kilometres per year. So that RAV4 Hybrid would use around $900 worth of fuel in a year.
Just to clarify on that as well, it takes 91 regular unleaded, and in Victoria, where we're sitting as of right now, the average price for 91 is $1.91.4.
Yes. So based on that, $900 worth of fuel a year, 12-month, 15,000-kilometre service intervals, and they're $230 capped price, and you're getting most likely oil and filter change, tyres checked, all the safety checks. So that's what you're looking at in the service for RAV4. So let's go to James. Run us through the GWM Aura.
Okay, so we've used the base model, which recently got its price cut to $35,990 drive away, which is now the cheapest EV in Australia. You get cap price servicing for 5 years at $99 a pop. And so we've used the average electricity price in Victoria based on Momentum Energy's quote at 27.29 cents per kilowatt hour. So if you were to charge it at home based on an average consumption rate of 16.7 kilowatt hours over 100 kilometres over a 10,000 kilometre yearly mileage, there's so many numbers, at home for the year it would cost you about $455.74 to charge at home. And then using the public charger, so EV chargers at 65 cents per kilowatt hour at their fastest, most expensive 350 kilowatt charger. And using that, it would be $1,085.50 for fast charging. So if you want to average those two values together, it's about $770 to do 50-50 of those for a year.
And for the sake of clarity on that EV number, because I have no doubt there's someone with an electric car jumping in the comments right now to chastise us, we've chosen a 350 kilowatt charger here because we want consistent numbers across the three vehicles. The Model Y and the EV9 can both take close to full advantage of a 350 kilowatt. The Aura can't, but given the pricing generally ranges from 50 kilowatts to 350, for the sake of consistency, that's why we've gone with that ultra rapid charger.
Yeah, so basically that's worst case scenario. Yeah. You're on the highway somewhere and you need to recharge your car. Just out of curiosity, that $99 service, what are we actually getting in that?
I think it's like just a standard logbook service. So for EVs, you don't have to do like oil changes or anything like that, but it's like a general safety check. They'll do a once over of the car. They might, you know, service items like your washer fluids and things like that. And then anything else that needs to be actioned, they'll do that as well. They'll probably check your diagnostics and your electrics and things like that.
The tyre rotation, things like that, yep.
And in 2024, software updates are a big thing. We've seen with a number of, especially Chinese brands on their electric cars, a couple of different software updates already for things like infotainment, driver assists. You can obviously go back to your dealer if you read about them online and get it done at any point, but every 12 months they also check for software updates, any active recalls on the car that haven't been done, stuff like that.
Okay, so just to recap the Aura, if you want to fast charge it all year long, you're looking around $1,000 plus $99 for service. If you have it at home, charge it all year long, probably around that $500 mark. And if you have a very fortunate workplace that'll let you charge it, you can probably save a bit of money there. But yeah, you're looking at least $500 a year to run that car.
Something like that.
Yeah. And that doesn't take into account if you have solar and things like that, which can offset that.
Or your registration insurance. We've tried to keep this simple-ish.
So we're base it on the base numbers. But that's a fairly cheaper than a RAV4 Hybrid. Model Y, let's move on to that. Scott, do you want to take that one?
I've got my cheat sheet here. Aura is significantly cheaper than a RAV4. It's also significantly smaller. The interesting thing with the Model Y is it's actually more efficient than the Aura based on the official government claim and based on our experience, which makes it the cheapest of these three cars here to run based on its charging costs. Base model has a base price of $63,900 before on-roads. That's a recent price cut. Tesla doesn't do scheduled servicing in the same way as other brands. It suggests an annual or a biannual, or an every 2 years checkup. Biannual and biennial, I'm never sure about. essentially a safety check. So make sure the brakes are all in good order, the tires are all in good nick, fluids are all up to scratch. If there is something wrong with your car or if there is some maintenance required, it's generally going to let the owner know, and then they expect you to use the app to order service through Tesla. So a little bit different to what we're used to. Because of that, the cap price servicing costs are not really comparable to what we're getting from an Aura. So
when Tesla don't list anything either in terms of that.
So we've left that out here because it doesn't really exist in a form that's fair to compare. Using the average consumption based on the Aussie government figures of 14.6 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometres, if you're only using a 350 kilowatt EV DC fast charger, you're looking at about $950 per year to charge. And if you're charging at home, you're looking at $398.43 according to that Victorian Momentum Energy price. If you do want to do 50-50 charging, and again, your own usage will vary, but this is just another number we can throw in for reference, you're looking at about $673 per year. So the interesting thing with the Model Y is the Model 3 and the Model Y are the most energy efficient electric vehicles on sale in Australia, and that's been our experience with them as well in testing. Compared not just to the Aura, but compared to the same size RAV4, it really is possible to save some money on your running costs. The inverse of that, and again, we haven't gone into this, maybe this is one for another episode, but insuring a Tesla at the moment is expensive because replacement parts can be hard to come by. And that is something that owners are sort of struggling with a little bit. I know Paul, our very own Marich, has had some trouble getting insurance for his Model Y. Maybe that's one for down the track, but these cars are still rarer on the roads than cars from other brands like Toyota, and that does have some other payoffs in other costs that are a little bit harder to quantify based on where you live and that sort of thing. So stay with us on that one.
Yeah. So I guess the big difference between the RAV and the Model Y is about $20,000 in the initial purchase price. So that's that, and realistically, you're not going to get that back with running the Model Y. It's not going to, theoretically, you're not going to save any money by buying the Tesla over buying the RAV.
Not unless you run it for a very long time.
But yeah, maybe 20 years or so.
But sorry.
The other aspect of that, though, is that if you do it via a novated lease and you get the FBT exemptions, that gap
narrows
quite a lot because the RAV4 is only a normal hybrid, not a plug-in one, so there's no incentive for it. So I think that's where a lot of people who are buying these are seeing benefits as well, because that thing shifts quite a bit once you factor in all these other ways of purchasing as well.
I think the other thing worth mentioning there is the base RAV4 is pretty stripped out. It's got cloth seats, it's got a nice enough interior, whereas the Model Y is a nicer thing inside. You can spend more than $55,000 on a RAV4. In that case, you are getting a sort of equivalent interior spec. But when you look at, a similarly luxurious RAV4 to how a Model Y is set up, that price gap narrows further. So it is worth considering that fact as well.
Okay, so just to recap, little under $1,000 a year to run the Model Y of fast chargers.
To fuel it.
Yep. Little under $400 a year to home charge, and just under $700 to 50-50 it. So again, before you attack us in the comments, I understand Tesla supercharging is different to EV charging, but we're just trying to make it as simple for everyone. There's EV chargers everywhere, fairly consistent. All right, James. Take us through the land barge that is the Kia EV9.
Yes, so the most affordable EV9 is the Earth rear-wheel drive, which is $97,000 before on-road costs.
That's because there's a lot of Earth that's gone into making it, isn't it?
Oh, a lot of rare Earth, yeah.
So that uses an average of 19.5 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometres according to official numbers. The five-year cap price servicing plan is $1,351, which is quite a bit more than the other two cars.
That's about $270 a year, if you were to break it down over 5 years.
Yes, and then so to fast charge it over the same period as the other two cars, it would cost you $1,950.65, which is quite a lot of money. It's also got a really big battery, and $532.15 at home. If you do 50-50, it's $1,241.39, so quite a bit more. But that car is also quite a bit bigger and more expensive than both of those other cars.
I think the problem that you're going to run into with trying to charge your EV9 at home, if you don't have a three-phase setup, is you will never charge it. Like, it'll take weeks to charge it off a three-pin outlet. And that's what we're basing the home charging on. It's just a 240-volt three-pin outlet.
So to sort of, I suppose, wade into that as well, I know a lot of Tesla owners, for example, only have a three-pin plug at home. My grandma is one of them. But if your normal commute isn't that long, if you're only doing 30 Ks a day, 40 Ks a day, and you plug it in every night, you're always going to have a full battery. I suppose the other thing with an EV9 is it is a big family car, and my first thought with big family car is big family road trip. Mm-hmm. And if you are going to be doing that and you've got a weekend at your destination and a 3-pin plug, you are going to very quickly realise that that is not enough grunt to get you a full battery again.
Yep. Yep. So, look, I guess just to recap the numbers on the EV9 before we move on, little under $2,000 a year if you were to only fast charge it. Yep. A bit over $500 to home charge it, which is realistic. It's not very realistic based off a 3-pin outlet. And then about $1,250 to split it. So, and I think that if you have a car like that, you probably are going to split it more than maybe a GWM.
It definitely feels more likely with the way people use those family cars.
Yeah. So, yes, and like you said, the road trips, the Aura is more likely around the city and the EV9 is probably more likely going to be up the Hume Highway. So the long and the short of it is EVs may cost less to run in a year, but your initial outlay is generally higher unless you're happy to go for one of these smaller cars. I guess that's the takeaway at this point in time.
I think as well, I suppose it's one for the listeners, viewers, readers, but are you interested in knowing what it costs to insure these three cars relative to a RAV4, for example? Because we can happily drop in more of this info. It's something we've been asked about quite a lot, but it's also a lot of numbers. So curious for some feedback on whether it is interesting content that's useful to people or whether we should just stop and start talking about jumping Ford trucks or something.
Yes. Right. Well, so, and one final thing I want to add is if you're not really sold on yet, buy a plug-in hybrid. It does both.
Don't buy a plug-in hybrid. Sean and I disagree on this, but it also does neither, depending on how you use it.
That's true. Okay, well, I think that's enough numbers for this week. I'm all mathed out for the month of March, so I think it's time to move on. The question this week, guys, is which large SUV would you buy? We've run a story on the website, so if you've already seen it on the website, you probably know the answers, but for those who haven't seen it yet, let's go with James first. What large SUV would... Wait. I'm sensing something. It's a Volkswagen Group product.
Or it could be.
I don't know. Sorry. Go on, James. What is it?
Okay, so to provide some background, the task was to choose a monocoque SUV or passenger road buyer's SUV as well as a ladder frame one that's more rugged. So my passenger focus one was an Audi Q7 because we were allowed to choose premium marks as well.
I need to start putting bets down. I mean, the odds won't be that great, but I could make some money out of this.
Well, look, I justify with the fact that the Q7 is a really great all-rounder. If you can justify the outlay for it, which a lot of people do, it's a really great car that has three rows of seats. It's got a great six-cylinder diesel engine. It's got a wonderful cabin, even in the base spec. It's really nicely made. It looks great. It's got this really nice understated class about it. So if you want something that's a bit nicer but doesn't, you know, completely break the bank like some of its rivals do, I think it's a really great option.
It's also kind of old now, so I guess it's been tested for a while, so I guess we know it's good, we know it works.
Yeah, right? And the fact that it shares its bones with some really, really expensive stuff like the Bentley Bentayga and Lamborghini Urus, so it's got some really solid foundations there. My body on frame pick was the Ford Everest, in particular one of the V6 ones, purely because having driven those, you know, a lot of these ladder frame SUVs or four-wheel drives have long been quite agricultural and unrefined and not really something that you would use if you were to mainly be totting around the city. But I think what the Everest does is it really puts a lot of its rivals to shame in the fact that it does drive like a normal, you know, monocoque SUV. It's very refined, it's very usable day-to-day, and just really comfortable and luxurious to drive. So that's why I chose that. Plus, it has the ability to go off-road and tow if you need.
Mm. All right, Scott, what are your pick or picks?
So my off-road-oriented pick, I was informed, is upper large, not just large, but it's the Toyota Land Cruiser 300.
I understand the FCAI has their own ways of doing it, but let's be honest, people just see a big SUV as a big SUV,
And for me, it's a 300.
Yep, fair enough.
Like the Everest, it is quite polished. You could very happily drive it every day on the road, and then in our testing, towing, off-roading, it's done an incredible job. So that 300, I still wish it had a better interior and better interior tech, but as an all-rounder that'll do the off-roading stuff, it's an absolute winner. Road-oriented, I've gone the BMW X5 instead of the Audi Q7. I really enjoyed driving the Q7 last year. We had the SQ7 with the petrol V8 through, but for me, the BM is just a bit nicer to drive. I think it's a better size as well. I don't need the third row. It feels a bit more car-like to drive, and I love BMW's diesel engines.
Mm, oh, they are sweet. I mean, Ineos have put them in their cars, so I think that says a lot about their off-road credentials and their reliability and diversity. So that's pretty cool. Well, if you're having trouble choosing between those cars or any other car on the market, you should head to Help Me Car Expert on Google and try out the Car Chooser. It's actually a really neat tool that I know James has been struggling to pick whether he wants a Skoda or a Volkswagen. He's been playing with the Car Chooser. But if you're struggling to decide what car that you should consider buying next, Help Me Car Expert, try out the Car Chooser. And if you do, let us know how did it work? Could we change anything? Could we improve anything? Did you get the result you wanted? Or was there a result that surprised you? So head to Help Me Car Expert on Google. Okay, the review this week, we're looking at the Kia Sportage Hybrid. Now, James, you were into us for a while to film this video because there's been so many requests. People kept harassing you. Where is the video? Where is the video?
Yes.
We finally got one. We did a video. It's on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, feel free to go and check it out. But you drove the car. So I want to hear some of your thoughts. But just tell us, what are the headline figures with the Kia Sportage Hybrid that everyone's been apparently waiting for a long time for?
So it's available in two versions. One is about 45 grand. The second one is 55. So you sort of have RAV4 GXL money or RAV4 Cruiser Edge money. It's got a turbocharged hybrid drivetrain with a more conventional six-speed automatic, which is a little bit different to some other hybrids that we have. And it's very much just a Kia Sportage. So anyone who loves a Kia Sportage that has been wanting an electrified option finally has one.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, it only comes in front-wheel drive.
Correct. In Australia, anyway, it only comes as a front-wheel drive.
Well, we're talking about cars that are sold in Australia, let's just stick to that. But yeah, okay, so this is the thing that gets tricky with hybrid cars is the power figures. So I've provided it on the cheat sheet there if you need a bit of help, but run us through how the numbers work in terms of the power outputs on this car.
So the system output is 169 kilowatts and 350 newton meters. So the petrol engine is basically the same one that's in the turbo petrol Sportage, so 132 kilowatts, 265 newton meters. The electric motor makes 44 kilowatts and 264 newton meters. So the difference between the Sportage, well, Kia and Hyundai's hybrid system compared to something like a Toyota is that the electric motor is actually mounted to the transmission. So sometimes you might actually feel, even in electric mode, it actually shifts through gears, which is a little bit different. I believe Toyota doesn't normally quote torque outputs for the system because the peaks don't meet at the same time, whereas this one offers it for a certain period when you need it.
So, it does feel like, and I know you probably agree with me, it pretty much feels like a normal Sportage to drive. I guess it just feels a little smoother off the line and that sort of stuff. But the claims on the fuel figures.
Yeah, which is probably an important thing to mention.
This is where it starts to fall apart because as we just spoke about earlier in the podcast, RAV4, 4.7, we often see those numbers when we drive a RAV4 hybrid. I mean, when we did a mega test, we were under 5 litres per 100. When we've had them on the road, they're normally
five,
around
five and a half, something like that, which is within touching distance.
They're pretty good numbers. The Kia didn't fare so well with our testing, did it?
So I think in your video, Paul was saying about 5.5 or just over that. And then in my testing, because I did quite a long road trip, which is probably where the hybrid and the diesel differ quite a bit, I was seeing in the 6 to mid 6s. This is obviously probably more skewed to city driving where you can sort of lean on the electric motor a little bit more. But yeah, we haven't quite seen it match that very ambitious claim of 4.9 litres per 100 Ks. I tried to drive it in the, not any more different to how I would normally drive a car. I'm fairly measured in how I drive in day-to-day scenarios, but I think just the, in terms of where I live in a hilly area, for example, that might put more strain on the petrol engine as opposed to, I tend to see better fuel figures out of the Toyota equivalent.
So, and this is a thing that we've seen a lot with Kia hybrids, we've had it with Sorento hybrid, that the numbers that we actually end up getting are sort of not quite as good as they should be, especially from a hybrid thing. Do you think the Kia is just still working out the hybrid tech or?
I don't know that it's about working out the tech, but I do think that different systems perform differently in test conditions. You look at how the Toyota system works and once you're off the mark, the electric motor is still very active in every time you lift off the accelerator. In the Kia system, based on my experience of it, it's very helpful at lower speeds. The petrol engine cuts in and out, but it operates differently, and that might mean in the official WLTP testing, which we also nick for ADR, it performs better than in the real world where you drive differently and the system operates differently. And it wouldn't be the first time a car may, I'm not saying this is a nefarious or a deliberate cheat thing, but it's more these hybrid systems benefit consumers, but they also benefit car makers by lowering their official fleet averages. Kia and Hyundai potentially have designed their system so that it also performs really strongly on that test, and that may be why we see that gap.
Okay, so it could just be use case. Okay. Now, one thing I was curious about, I've often found that the Sportage is quite nice to drive around. It kind of feels sporty, but it's comfortable. I felt like the hybrid, it was a bit more wallowy. It felt like the suspension wasn't quite as nice. I don't know whether you found that, but I felt like it just wasn't quite as good as the all-wheel drive petrol, for instance.
Yeah, it was definitely a touch softer from how I felt it. I think what Kia does is that they do local tuning for all their new models, but then even within nameplate ranges, they have different tunes for each drivetrain. So perhaps for the hybrid, because you've got the battery and you have to offset all that kind of stuff, it may have been a slight difference there. The fact that it's a front-wheel drive versus an all-wheel drive, weight distribution might be another thing. So I did notice that too, but I still found it like it felt quite secure and nice and solid to drive. It just perhaps wasn't as dynamic as some of the other variants in the range. Mm.
So all in all, a good car. I mean, I think it does everything that a Kia needs to do. If you have been driving a Sportage for a while and you jump into this, I think you're going to feel right at home. The big question is, would you have this over a RAV4 hybrid? Now, Scott, I'll come to you because you haven't actually driven the Sportage hybrid, but James, having driven both, where would you land?
I think if you're more interested in something that is perhaps a little bit more fun to drive, the way that this drivetrain operates is a little bit more engaging and a bit nicer to use than something with a CVT, then I would definitely give this a look. And you'll get better fuel economy if you're driving mainly in town, which is what this is designed to do. I think what Toyota has done has just made their hybrids so efficient in the real world that anyone can really get a good fuel figure. If your outright priority is to use as little fuel as possible, I think the RAV4 is really hard to beat.
Okay, and there's not much, it's $3,000 difference in them. Like it's not a lot of money. So yeah, it's a tough one. All right, Scott, on purely based on the paper review of the Sportage, where would you use it?
I would end up with a Honda CR-V.
That wasn't an option, Scott, but okay.
So this base model obviously is much cheaper than the CR-V, but looking at the top spec, they cross over very closely. And the CR-V for me is a really good looking, really spacious, really comfortable, fun to drive car. I like the RAV4. I think I'd probably prefer a RAV over a Sportage based on what I know of them. But of the lot, CR-V hybrid for me.
Okay. Well, once again, Scott has brought an option that wasn't on the table.
Play by wild card.
Anyway, all right. Well, let's give Scott some free reign then.
Yeah, I'm doing my best Crawford impersonation this week.
All right. What is your pick this week, Scott?
So my pick this week is actually something that we've run on the website. It's the CTEC CS1 battery charger and jump starter. Now, this is not sponsored content. I want to make that very clear, even though it sounds like it. But we have this unit in and we're working on putting together a review of it. But I was having a fiddle around and a read, and it's like a little unit that if your battery is flat, can be used to jump start the car. It's also designed to be idiot proof, and I am an idiot.
Yep, we know.
So it's got these clamps that you don't have to put on the right side of the battery. They're non-polarity clamps.
Universal clamps.
That's what I was after.
So there's no positive and no negative. It doesn't matter.
There's lots of positives and no negatives from what I can see.
Yes, but it doesn't matter which one you use on which battery.
Exactly. Okay. So it's tech that on paper seems really interesting. We're waiting for your XR8 battery to die.
That's for any second now.
And then we're going to give it a go and put a review on the website. It's something we're going to be doing a little bit more of with aftermarket stuff. So this is part one, but I think it's an interesting product, and I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more.
Well, not sponsored by whatever it's called, but definitely sponsored by Car Experts.
So. It might be terrible, and the review will be really negative, in which case it definitely won't be sponsored.
Yes. Well, then that's where they'll send you the bill for it. All right, James, what is your pick this week?
I found a very interesting video of Gordon Ramsay getting into his very exclusive, very unique Aston Martin
Villa over the
weekend. Oh. And it's in like Aston Martin racing green with like the lime highlights and calipers and everything. Basically decked out like the F1 car is. But this car's worth like, I don't even know how much. It's like some crazy millions and millions of pounds worth. And he's just driving it through London casually. And he like came out of a restaurant in like a hoodie and runners. So like it was just quite an interesting video to watch, and seeing that car drive around was really cool.
That car reminds me so much of that 70s Vantage that they had, the one that looked like a muscle car, and I actually saw one on the road not long ago. It's a red one. It was lovely. They were a lovely looking car, and this new one looks absolutely,
I think that's what it's meant to look like.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, they nailed it.
There is a garage, and I'm not going to say exactly where because this person probably doesn't want everyone to know, but I was driving home from work recently, and there was a BMW iX pulling out of a garage, and he was sort of going on the footpath a little bit to get, rather than into the traffic, onto the side street. It looked like it was all set up for it. I'm not calling this person out for doing that. But the garage was open for quite a while, and I was stuck in traffic. I looked into this garage, and there was an old Vantage of that era. There was an SLR 5000 Tirana. There was a very expensive looking Porsche 911 from the 70s. It was a really special little garage that I've driven past pretty much every day for the last 3 years and hadn't noticed before. But that Aston Martin stood out immediately. It's got such a beautiful shape to it.
Absolutely, yes. I'm sure it was a Bond car at some point, but I don't know why. I just have that memory of that Aston Martin and it's just stunning. My pick is... I found on YouTube, not on YouTube, it was on Instagram. It should be on YouTube, but it's on Instagram, an account called M4 Maloo.
Oh, okay.
It is exactly what it sounds like. Someone has taken a BMW M4 and put a tray on the back and they're calling it an M4 Maloo. And it, look, it's not a Maloo, obviously. I don't think they quite understand what a Maloo is, like they're, like a Maloo being a word meaning thunder, but they obviously have heard of Maloo and said, well, it's a ute, so we're just going to make it a ute. The thing that gets me is it looks really cool. It's great. BMW could make it. Why don't you, BMW? Make an M4 Ute. Let's bring back a... We need more performance Utes. That would be sick. I would have an M4 Ute. I mean, I couldn't afford an M4 Ute, but I would love one.
This is one of those ones, and I'm shaking my head not because I don't like the idea, because I love it, but car people are incredibly good at going... That'd be really cool.
Yep.
Now, this is the brown manual wagon thing, right? In the US, they talk about it, some of the magazines. We want a brown manual diesel wagon. Yep. And car makers occasionally give in and they build it and three people buy them and they never get built again. It is a cool idea, but no, it's not a good idea. No, BMW should not build it.
Yes, well, if you would like an M4 Maloo, write to BMW. Maybe send a deposit as well so they know you're serious. All right, well, that pretty much brings us to the end this week, guys. I'm not going to give you any homework this week. We'll be back to normal operations. This was a lot. it took us a while to put together, but hopefully it's given you guys at home some understanding of EV running costs, even if it's just really high level, because that's all it is, because you could start diving into tire costs, brake wear, everything else that comes with it, you know. So I think hopefully that gives people who are, you know, on the fence about an EV a bit of a better understanding, and, you know, might get them across the line on it or might completely turn them away.
What if happens?
Before we wrap up, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I did about 1,300 Ks on the road last weekend. I had two country weddings to get to. And I would just like to call out the actually decent state of driving. There were some really courteous drivers on Victorian highways.
Oh, there you go.
There were some terrible
ones. Because you weren't in Melbourne, that's probably...
Yeah, absolutely.
What were you driving out there, by the way?
I had a BMW X1 M35i review coming to the website soon. I've got some photos of it at various dilapidated country servos and pubs.
It looks fantastic, by the way, that car. Like, really, not the pubs, the car.
Don't drink at the pubs as well. Really chunky looking little thing and much more grown up than the last one. I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, cool. Any final thoughts from you, James?
I just can't believe how many crap drivers are in Melbourne at the moment.
Yes, well, that ain't going to change anytime soon. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in this week. I really hope we haven't broken you. If you're still listening, thank you so much. Make sure you like and subscribe if you're on YouTube. Click follow if you're listening on one of the audio platforms. We will be back next week with much less math, we promise. We will see you then.